It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you've read the work of Jacqueline Woodson, her National Book Award-winning Brown Girl Dreaming, her National Book Award-nominated novel for adults, Another Brooklyn, or any of her literature for young people, then you probably know why fans, parents, teachers, librarians, and booksellers light up when they hear her name. If you haven't read any of her work, you're missing out on one of the most powerful voices of our time. Jacqueline Woodson is the 2018-2019 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. She received the 2018 Astrid Lindgren Memorial Award and the 2018 Children's Literature Legacy Award. And in the midst of all that, she's also just released two new books, The Day You Begin, illustrated by Rafael Lopez. It's a picture book that's perfect for any child or adult who's felt nervous or different in school. And Harbor Me, a middle grade novel that shares the stories of a diverse group of Brooklyn fifth and sixth graders. She's coming to Iowa. She'll be at the Englert Theater in Iowa City on Saturday, September 8th, in an event sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore. There are tickets still available for that event. And she's with me on the line. Jacqueline, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Now, being named the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature is a really tremendous honor. Congratulations on that. And I'm wondering what it has meant for you.
It's meant a lot of work. So, and I think that's both good and bad. I think it's meant me coming to recognize how important the role is to not only the young people in our country, but all people in our country, that sense of recognizing the importance of literature and how what an impact it can have on our lives, on our communities, on our families, and how it's through it we're able to garner language and understanding and empathy. And to get that message across and to get more people to be with me in that way, it means a lot of traveling. It means a lot of going into rooms with young people and adults and going into prisons and juvenile detention centers and being away from home a lot, which makes me miss my family.
Yeah.
And so it's a complicated and thought-provoking position for me. And I'm eternally grateful for it, and I'm grateful for how it's grown me, and I'm grateful for the chance to do the work. And I'm also thinking about how it's, you know, sometimes you're put here to do the work you didn't think you wanted to do, but you do it anyway because it's work that needs to be done.
Well, I want to talk more about that. I mean, what do you see all of that traveling, all of those conversations that you're able to have because of this, the doors that open to you or that you can ask to be open to you? What do you feel like you're able to accomplish?
My hope is that I'm able to, first and foremost, get young people to see themselves in literature and thereby have a better sense of their legitimacy and power in the world, especially underserved people, especially indigenous and people of color, queer people, trans people, people who have historically been unrecognized or are not seeing themselves as part of this North American narrative. I think I don't know how much I've done. I've seen faces light up. I've had amazing conversations with young people. I've gone into rooms where people have never met an author before, and we've connected and chatted and wrote together. And so for me individually, I know the work I want to do. I know the change I want to create. I think I would be dishonest to say, you know, I walked in the room and changed the lives of people forever. I would like to do that, and that's my hope that people are changed. I've seen a lot of young people who are very afraid at this moment in time. I've seen a lot of people who are very eager and hungry for their lives on the page. I've met a lot of people who are going to be writers or already are writers. And I've met a lot of adults who are doing amazing work with young people and really passionate about it. And I see the change they're making.
Do you have much control about where you go and what you do, or is this an itinerary that's set for you?
No, it's an itinerary that I can choose the places I go. At the beginning of my ambassadorship, a number of people, we put out a call for people to request my presence, and so we got lots of proposals. I don't even know how many hundreds. And from those proposals, I could choose where I wanted to go. As ambassador, I only have to do 10 visits per year. But once all the proposals started coming in, and even as I travel around the country, I see that that's not enough. I mean, beyond those proposals, I've also gone out on my own and gone into places that weren't on the list of the people we've chosen. This morning, I was doing an interview for SiriusXM, and we got to talking about a school just outside of D.C. that sounded really interesting, and I asked my publicist to put it on my list for visiting when I'm back here in January. So stuff like that comes up. Sometimes people email me requests, and there's something that I am able to do and want to do, and I'm doing more Skype visits than I have to do, but I have to do them because the need is there.
And you mentioned some of the kinds of spaces that you're visiting in going to juvenile detention centers or places where maybe most people wouldn't think that the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature is going. Who are you hoping to reach?
Why would they think that's not a place I would be going?
Well, it's I'm not saying that it isn't a place you should be going. I'm saying that perhaps other ambassadors in the past haven't.
They have.
Okay. So what are your priorities? When you look through that list of all of those proposals, what are the ones that really speak to you?
All of them. That's what's so sad about it. I mean, every proposal I read is a place that, yeah, they could use my voice in that room. They could use my presence. They could use my platform and the means by which I talk about it. So I think what speaks to me most is the first thing I look at is the places that don't have any kind of structure in place. So I was in Alabama for the Equal Justice Initiative, and I went to a juvenile detention center there in Alabama that hadn't had a writer there ever. You know, I mean, they had, I'm sorry, a published writer or an award-winning writer and who was Black and female and, you know, who could walk in the room and engage with them in this other kind of way. And I know that sounds kind of I don't know. It feels conceited, but it's a very specific thing, and there are a lot of young people in underserved communities who have never met writers. And I think meeting someone who's making a living as a writer who came from their own underserved community is very important in terms of young people having a mirror. So that's one thing I look at. I look at homogenous communities. We got a proposal from Maine, and Maine is very, very white and has very few people of color. And I think for a place like that, it's good for them to be exposed to more literature by people of color and to hear people of color come in and speak. And so it really, really varies. But I break down the need first and then my desire to go there. It's like, oh, do I really want to trek all the way to Maine? And then my time, like how I'm going to fit it into my schedule, and the passion. I look for the passion in the proposal and the work that people are doing, because it takes work to get me someplace, right? You have to kind of work to prep the community or prep the readers, say making them read books, making them go to my website, and really getting them eager for my presence, so I'm not just some stranger walking into a space. So I'm looking for the people who are able to do that work, but sometimes I ignore that because sometimes people can't do that work. It's enough for them to write the proposal and say, you know, if you come here, it will mean the world to these 15 kids who are in foster care, who don't even own books, like, so that kind of thing.
It sounds overwhelming. Is it, are you having a hard time reserving space for yourself and your family and your writing?
I got the self-care thing pretty down. Like, before this phone call, I was at the gym. I'm going to go back to the gym after the phone call and stretch. And I was watching the Aretha funeral, which I'm going to go back to watching because it's fun to watch. I mean, it's so great to see all these people and to see it in a black church and to see people paying homage to the Queen. So I have an amazing village of people who I stay in contact with via texting or phone or Skyping, you know, just to keep me grounded. I've learned how to say no. So all of that stuff does help a lot.
Jacqueline Woodson, she is a National Book Award winner for her lyrical memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. She was also National Book Award nominated for her adult novel, Another Brooklyn. And she's just released two new books. Harbor Me is a middle grade novel that tells the story of a diverse group of Brooklyn 5th and 6th graders. We'll talk about that book in depth in a little while. She's also just released a picture book called The Day You Begin, illustrated by Rafael Lopez. It's a book for any child or adult who's ever felt nervous or different going to school. She will be in Iowa City at the Englert Theater Saturday, September 8th. This is an event sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore, and tickets are still available. There's also an opportunity when you buy tickets to buy additional tickets for at-risk youth. You can also just make a donation of tickets for at-risk youth on the Englert website. Again, that's coming up Saturday, September 8th. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Jacqueline Woodson. She won the National Book Award for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. She also, right now, has been named the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. She's traveling the country. In that regard, she also has just released two new books. One is called Harbor Me, a middle grade novel that shares the stories of a diverse group of Brooklyn fifth graders. She's also released a picture book called The Day You Begin, illustrated by Rafael Lopez. And she'll be in Iowa City on Saturday, September 8th at the Englert Theater. There are still tickets available to that event. And when we were talking about how busy you are right now as ambassador, I am curious about how you carve out time for writing, given all of the demands on your time right now. How do you make that work?
Writing is, it really is like breathing to me. Like, I need to do it all the time, just about. And I need to do it every day, and it's part of my self-care. So I make the time. When this past summer, I wrote a lot at night because my kids weren't in school, so I could hang with them during the day and then write at night and then sleep late. Because whereas during the school year, I can't do that. I have to get to bed because I have to get up early with them. They were away at camp for 5 weeks. I got a lot of writing done then. And so, you know, I'm disciplined about my time. I'm on deadline now for an adult book I'm writing, and I know that I'm going to be writing tomorrow morning. I'm going to be writing after an interview on Sunday afternoon while I'm traveling back to New York City, and then I'm going to write a lot on Monday. So I really try to figure out when my writing periods of time are and stick to them. And I always listen to music when I write. I know when I'm working on a book that I can't listen to the news too much, so I kind of go into a bubble and let people just inform me of the important stuff.
I want to talk about your childhood. And I know that books were extremely important to you as a child. You've written a lot about that in Brown Girl Dreaming and your relationship to books. You had a difficult time as a reader. You were a slow reader. Tell me about the role that books played in your life as a child.
Well, picture books were really important for a very, very, very long time. Long after other people seemed to stop reading picture books, I was still very much into them. And I would read the same books over and over because it was helping me learn to read, and it was also helping me learn to write. So it's interesting. I think it was a processing thing because I see it in my children. And it's that question of... I think if I had been born in another time, I would have gotten diagnosed as dyslexic. But given that when I was born and where I was, that was not the case. After I read Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath, and what she talks about, wondering if people should get diagnosed, because I wonder if I had gotten diagnosed, would I be a writer now? Because I quote-unquote, struggled to read, but I was reading. I was reading differently from other people, but I was reading and deconstructing literature and, by extension, learning how to write, which is, I think, the reason for the way I read was because from a very, very, very young age, I was a writer. But in a regular old school system, they're not trying to have that. They're trying to have you read fast and read above your grade level and all of that stuff. So I think looking back on it, I think if writing hadn't kind of been my salvation, I would have probably been a really bummed kid and think I wasn't so smart.
A lot of kids turn away from books when they have that kind of trouble reading, but it sounds like you turned toward them.
Yeah. I didn't have a choice. My mom was not gonna let us not read. It was just it was a part of. We have very limited TV, and we were made to read often, and we always had library cards that were current, and we had to go to the library every day after school. We had weekly trips to the library to return our books. I mean, it was just my family was a text-based family, so it wasn't even a question.
What were your touchstone books when you were a kid, the ones that you went back to again and again?
The Selfish Giant by Oscar Wilde was a huge book for me. Little Match Girl. Stevie was a book I loved and still love. Those are the books that I could just pick up. Harold and the Purple Crayon again and again, and just take myself back to that place in my early childhood. Then later on, I think one of the books that first spoke to me that I really understood was a book called Zeely by Virginia Hamilton, and then Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry by Mildred Taylor, and then I discovered Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and If Beale Street Could Talk and A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and those were when I read them very, very slowly and very, very deeply and again and again and again.
Well, you mentioned earlier helping young people find mirrors for themselves in literature. And, you know, that's one of the things that thankfully we've seen changing, in large part thanks to your work, but in part thanks to the work of so many others as well, that more kids can see themselves in a book now. Do you remember, and you may have just told me, but do you remember the first time that you felt like you were holding a mirror in your hands when you were reading?
I think it was definitely Zeely, Virginia Hamilton's book about a sister and a brother, and they travel from the south to the north, and I just saw myself and my family in those kids. Then it was Roll of Thunder, definitely, in the role of Cassie Logan. I saw lots of Jacqueline Woodson.
Did you, when you saw yourself in the book, I mean, that's an experience that hopefully most young readers have. Did you have an awareness of, oh, this hasn't been there in the other books that I was looking for? Or was it just more of a feeling of just loving it?
I definitely had that moment of, how dare the world show me this everywhere from a very young age. And again, I don't know if that was my family reinforcing that and saying you have a right to be represented, or me coming to those books and being like, so this is what I've been looking for. But it was definitely something.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've given the creation of that mirror a lot of thought. What do you think is so important for a child to be able to have that mirror, to be able to see someone or read about someone who reflects their own life?
I think it makes people less lonely, right? To see yourself reflected in the world. And it's only fair to know that you're part of this kind of continuum, or that you're part of something bigger. And so when you see those mirrors, when you finally open a book and say, that's me, it's like, not only am I right here reading the book, but I'm also a part of a bigger narrative because someone else is having a similar experience.
You have created mirrors for children in many different circumstances from many different backgrounds in
Harbor
so
Me,
much
is
of your
for
work.
Middle grade readers. You have presented us with this very diverse but tight-knit little group of children at a school in Brooklyn, and they represent so many different backgrounds. We'll talk more about the different backgrounds, but what was your inspiration? What made you want to write about this group?
It was a long time coming and figuring out who exactly the group would be. And each of them had a particular story that mattered to me, and that was part of something that I had been thinking about for years and years. And so as I created the characters and brought them together, the question I asked again and again was, if these kids got in a room together, what would they say to each other? And who would they become? And, you know, how would they change? And as a result, those are the young people I created.
Could I ask you how old your kids are?
Yeah, Jackson Leroy is 10 and Toshi is 16.
All right, so you've been through the fifth grade before and you're probably going through it right now.
Exactly. And the sixth, there is a sixth grade class in Harbor Me.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting time.
And I also remember myself in those grades. I mean, that's one thing about being a writer is you write remembering the child you were, because the essence of that doesn't change. And I didn't say that. I think it was Madeline Lingle who said it. But I did mine my own childhood and my own arguments with my brother to create Amari and Holly, and watching my own kids go at it, even though there's 6 years between them, to create some of the kind of the banter. But yeah, that it's those are ages I know well.
Well, and one of the things that I really love about your writing is, you write poetry, but even when you're writing prose, I feel your poetry as well. And you can give us so much with such a spare line or such a small detail. And one of the details that I loved in Harbor Me that kind of sums up that fifth and sixth grade time is the main character, Hallie. She really wanted this unicorn bedspread. And then suddenly it seemed childish to her. And as a parent, that just felt like such a blow. I mean, that's what we see in that time. It's that transition.
Mm-hmm. I know. And what I keep out of it is, because Harbor Me is about young people, is the part when the parent is like, but I just bought that for you. You had such a tantrum about wanting it.
The class that you write about in Harbor Me is a special needs class, but you don't really spell out why mm-hmm. they're in that class. Was that intentional?
No. Yes. Yeah, because I think it's important to know that people could be learning differently, and one could never know, or what their difference is doesn't have to be articulated or othered in some way.
That also broadens the mirror for a child mm-hmm. who may have a learning problem.
Exactly.
The we mentioned the incredible diversity of this group. So you have a boy whose family's from the Dominican Republic, and mm-hmm. his family's dealing with an immigration crisis, which I realize you didn't write this book this year, and immigration crises are not new, but to have it released at this moment in time is so powerful. What are your thoughts as his story goes out into the world?
Again, I hope the people like Esteban have those mirrors and see that they're not alone in it. As I was writing him, you know, I just came to love him more and more, especially when he gets to the point where he realizes he can translate his father's poetry. And I just hope people for whom this is a window to and not a mirror see that we're talking about bodies, we're talking about people, and grow to love him and grow to have empathy for not only what's happening in this country, but what's happening when people have to be separated. I mean, there are so many ways that people are separated through the prison industry complex, through immigration laws, through divorce, through death. But I think someone whose dad probably wasn't taken away by ICE can probably still see themselves in Esteban because maybe their dad was taken to prison, or maybe a family member left. But I think it brings solace to be able to read about someone and know that a part of you gets it deeply.
Another one of the characters, his family's from Puerto Rico, and of course Puerto Rico is part of the United States, and mm-hmm. he is now living in Brooklyn, but because his family is Spanish-speaking, he's treated like an outsider, and people have shouted things on the street to them about, you know, go back where you came from, go home. Again, I mean, you almost, I know that you probably wrote this before Hurricane Maria, and these questions that suddenly people had about, oh, Puerto Rico is part of the United States. Mm-hmm. Did you feel maybe a little clairvoyant again, this issue becoming even more prominent at this moment in time?
It just is so crazy. I think the thing about it is, like you said, this is stuff that has been going on for a long, long, long time. And it feels very current, but when we do look at it, we know that the issue of immigration, the issue of people thinking Puerto Ricans are not American, or not even knowing the geography of that, people being sent to prison, the displacement of people because of economics, as was in the case of Ashton, Amari, and the issue of not being able to play with guns in public because of Tamir Rice and people like that, but also because of, the history of police gunning down black boys is not a new history, especially to people in the black community. But with social media, it's become much more visible. So I think what I'm writing about in Harbor Me are things that some people have known about for a very, very long time, and some people see as new.
And they are things that are being talked about in probably not new ways, but mm-hmm. in just very, very emotional ways right now in our national
yeah.
conversation.
Exactly.
We're going to take another short break, and we'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is Jacqueline Woodson, and she's just released two new books. One is called Harbor Me. That's the one we've just been talking about, a middle grade novel that tells the story of a group of six very diverse
children in fifth and sixth grade in Brooklyn. And she also released a new picture book called The Day You Begin, illustrated by Rafael Lopez. She is the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and she'll be in Iowa City on Saturday, September 8th, in an event sponsored by Prairie Lights Bookstore at the Englert Theater. Tickets are still available for that event. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Jacqueline Woodson. She is very well known for her National Book Award winning Brown Girl Dreaming, which is a memoir, and her National Book Award nominated novel for adults, Another Brooklyn. She's just released two new books. Harbor Me is a middle grade book, and she's also released a new picture book called The Day You Begin. And we were just talking about the book Harbor Me for middle grade readers, and really I would say for anyone over middle grade as well. And one of the characters, the main character in the book, we've talked about, you know, some of the different backgrounds that people bring. The main character is a girl who's being raised by her uncle. Her father's in prison, her mother has passed away, and she struggles with her identity because her parents are missing from her life. But she also struggles with her identity because her father is white, her mother was black, and she doesn't look like anybody else. She has red hair, but in texture, it's like her mother's hair. And her young white uncle who's raising her has no idea how to deal with it. And she's faced with this question all the time, that is such a wrenching question to read, is what are you? So you write about so many of these characters who have identities that may be easy to sum up in just a few words. Her identity is not easy to sum up for her or for anyone. Why was that important to you?
I think a lot of young people hear that "what are you" question often, and it's a question people saying, "I do not understand this thing you're representing," and it's a question that is, I understand why it gets asked, but I don't understand why it's necessary. Why people need to know you're half black, you're half white, you're half Asian, you're half black, whatever the mix is. I'm raising two mixed race kids, so I watch my daughter getting asked that question, and it was funny, at one point she had on this shirt that I got from the Schomburg Museum that says "very black" on it, and she passed the brother, and he was like, "Nah, you ain't very black. You're mixed with something." And she, you know, she kind of didn't know how to respond to it. But I think for N. Haley, I feel like I wanted to show that. I wanted to show, here's a kid who has so many kind of identity politics things going on around her, that question of what are you is kind of almost a who are you question, that who in fifth, sixth grade can answer yet? I'm 55 and I still can't answer it. So I loved writing the character of Haley and getting her on the page to kind of represent some of the much bigger questions that young people are asking and being asked.
In describing the book, I feel like I'm doing it a disservice, because in talking about the issues that are part, that make up the book, that doesn't really capture the fact that it's just a really good read. And it will challenge you, it will make you think, but if I were in fifth or sixth grade, I think I'd just really enjoy it. Do you get frustrated sometimes with your work being picked apart for the issues, and
not looked at as just a really great read that any kid or any adult could really just sink themselves into?
I don't, because I don't listen to it. You know, no one's really, unless I'm doing an interview or something, and being asked to think about what the reasons behind the creation of the narrative. If academics are talking about my work, I'm not in the room with them. If they're writing about it on the internet, I'm not reading that. So the ones I have access to most are the young people who are engaging in it in a very different way. So I see their enjoyment, and I know when I touch them, even as I'm writing it, because I know when I've nailed a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old, or a moment between two kids, or even a moment between teenagers. Like I know it because it's what I do. It's how I write. And so the other kind of stuff comes later and from a different audience. And I of course, I can speak to that, but it's not what I'm as interested in as writing a good book.
Right. There's a story that you've shared a number of times, and I'll ask you to share it again, but your books have been challenged, have been banned in some places, and you talk about a phone call that you got from the author Judy Blume. Can you tell us about that?
Judy called me to ask me to contribute to an anthology she was writing, putting together, called The Places That I've Never Meant to Be. And it was an anthology of censored, banned, challenged writers. And I was like, well, I don't need to be in that. I've never been challenged. She's like, oh, yes, you have. And something like that. But I didn't know, because, again, no one's going to call me and say, Jacqueline Woodson, we're challenging your book. I'm like, they're going to not invite me to their schools. They're going to not have my books in their libraries, but no one's going to let me know, unless it's a friend who's like, I live in a state and your book's just been challenged. So, but again, it's not what I'm interested in at all. I mean, I was interested in writing for her anthology because I love Judy Blume, and of course, I'm not going to say no to her. But if someone is calling me and saying, we're challenging your book, I'm like, do what you need to do. The kids are going to find it. The kids are going to get what they need somehow. I mean, how do you? I remember from the Notebooks of Melanin Sun was given out to a whole school in Brooklyn, and then a parent called the principal and said, well, here's what this book's about. You need to take it back. And so the principal did an announcement over the PA systems asking everyone to return the book, and he got like 3 copies back.
So the book was already out there.
That's all you have to do for young people to say, don't read that.
And suddenly that's the hottest book going.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have a relationship with Judy Blume?
Yeah, we're friends. I mean, I know her. I know I can email her or call her and ask and chat with her. I mean, we're not best friends. We share the same birthday, but the children's book writing world is small, so we all know each other.
Well, there are lots of things about your books that feel kind of like Judy Blume books to me, in that the characters feel so real. And as a kid, I didn't read your books as a kid because I'm almost as old as you are, but the characters just feel so real. And you talk about the mirror, you know, kids recognize themselves in these books. But at the same time, adults who pick them up are like, wait a minute, kids shouldn't be reading about this kind of thing. They can't read about the world that they actually live in. And I feel like your books and Judy Blume's books both have that in common.
That's so funny. Yeah, I definitely read Judy Blume growing up, and Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was one of my favorites. What you just said, kids are in the world and they're bearing witness to it, and they need ways of articulating it, and books help them do that.
It reminds me, my daughter's in eighth grade, and we just went to see the movie Eighth Grade. And I told her, I said, it's rated R. And she's like, Mom, junior high is rated R.
That's great. It's so funny because I can't see it. I'm like, oh, I can't be in eighth grade that way again.
No, it's pretty
it's
painful.
Too much with me. I can write about it, but I can't watch it on the big screen.
It's your instincts are right. It's very painful.
this moment in time in children's literature, you plant some Easter eggs in Harbor Me, referring back to classics. I mean, you refer to A Tree Grows in Brooklyn quite a bit. And of course, the big metaphor in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn is that there's this tree, that the tree of heaven, that grows and they can't kill it. And the main mm-hmm. character is like that tree. And your kids in this book, they're those trees, too, growing in Brooklyn. But that harkens back to a classic. But I feel like right now in children's literature, there is so much incredible work being done. I feel like this is a golden age of children's literature, and you're part of this world right now. You're one of those writers making really incredible work. What does it feel like to be part of this moment?
I do hope it's more than a moment, right? I hope it's a movement. And I hope that it just goes and goes, and kids and adults, because I do think, as you said, adults can read this body of work, realize how much young people's literature is saying and doing and challenging, and how interesting the writers themselves are. And I'm extremely proud to be a part of it. I'm proud to have been in it before it was this. And when it was a smaller semblance of this, with, you know, Walter Dean Myers and Joyce Hanson and Virginia Hamilton and Arnold Adolph and all of the 90s writers who are doing this work and really trying to step up the game. And now we have not only all these extraordinary writers, but also young writers writing for young people. So I remember, you know, back in the day, you'd meet a writer and you would be surprised that they were in their 60s or 50s even. And how did they tell that story? And now you're seeing young people in their 30s and sometimes even in their 20s when you look at, like, Angie Thomas and, you know, Jason Reynolds is older, but not much. But these writers are also young themselves and really have their finger on the pulse of language and the community and the spaces that young people are inhabiting. So their writing is real and thoughtful and engaging.
When I was growing up as a reader, I mean, there were the classics, which I loved, and the stuff that was coming out in the 80s, maybe I didn't have access to a lot of the new stuff at that point anyway, but it paled in comparison to this. There's just so much good stuff coming out. Do you have advice for parents? Because I think parents keep recommending that their kids read the classics that they read when they were kids, and they should, and those are great. But there's just so much good stuff out there that I think a lot of parents mm-hmm. don't know about right now. Do you have advice for parents on how to connect their kids with that great literature?
I'm hoping one thing, school librarians tend to be really current on what's happening in literature, as do public librarians. So I would say talk to librarians, because it really depends. Is your child a child that loves graphic novels? Because then, of course, we have Raina, we have Jean, we have all of these people doing graphic novels. Is your child a person that loves fantasy? There's, you know, Donnell Clayton. There are all these people writing fantasy. So I think I am. DJ Older is one who's really thoughtful and interesting, but I mean, I'm blanking on some names, but I can go on. Look at lists. Look at the awards list. The Coretta Scott King list has interesting books. The National Book Award list for young people's literature has interesting books. WeNeedDiverseBooks.org has list of books. First Book has very current list. So there are all these places to go to just look at and see what are some of the books that are out there that might be interesting to your children, and read them with your young people. We do a family read where we have one book that the whole family reads, and if they can't read, we read it out loud. Like we did The Watsons Go to Birmingham, and my son was not reading at that level, so we read it as a read aloud. You know, one thing he does is listen to a lot of Jason Reynolds is audiobooks. Mm-hmm. So the younger people who aren't reading at that level can do the book as an audio book, but and then you could actually speak, talk as a family about what you're reading, and it, and it's fun and engaging and insightful.
Well, the speaking of audiobooks, and the Jason Reynolds audiobooks are a huge hit in my family as well. But the Harbor Me audiobook, that became a family affair for your family, right?
Yes, it
so did. Tell me about that.
So my daughter, who wants to be an actor, had wanted a part in the book. So my so she had to read the book, and they don't read a lot of my books, but she read it and auditioned for the role of Holly and got it. And then Jackson Leroy, my son, wanted to have a role in the book. He's 10, and he reads differently, so it would have been very hard for him to do it. So we suggested that he and I have a conversation at the end of the book, because he had read the book. And it was just a question of speaking the lines, like that process between the reading the lines as he's speaking them would have been very hard for him. If he had had more time, he might have been able to memorize them, but he just reads differently and had and has a younger, much younger voice. So we agreed that at the end that we'd have the conversation, and that conversation is my favorite part of the book. I mean, it's a place where tears well up because he said such surprising things that I hadn't expected. We just sat down in the studio, and we said, let's talk, let's ask each other questions, and we went back and forth, and he was great. He's great.
Well, now I'm going to have to get the audiobook, too. The something you just said, your kids don't read much of your books. So
no,
flesh
no.
that out for me a little bit. I mean, I guess, you know, as a mom, I have a really hard time recommending books to my kids, because if I lay it on too thick, there's absolutely no way they're going to read it. Do your kids, do you have that problem?
I leave them in the bathroom. I leave books to my kids in their bathroom.
Nice.
So accidentally. You know, if there's a book I want them to read, I don't mention it at all. I just leave it in their bathroom and make it look like I was reading it in there and forgot it. And invariably, they pick it up.
Well, I will have to try that. I've tried trying to seed them through teachers or librarians, but that's hard, too.
It is. And, you know, the thing about the Jason Reynolds books, and I'm sure your kids are the same, they love Guy's voice, right? The
yeah.
voice of the narrator.
Oh, he's
so
such
great.
A great reader, yeah.
I chose him to do the voice of Jeremiah in the audiobook of If You Come Softly, but Jackson was like, nah. So, well, maybe this will get him to read that book or listen to that book, but it didn't happen.
Well, it's somehow reassuring that you have the same struggles.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Jacqueline Woodson, we are out of time, but I have really, really enjoyed talking to you today, and I have really, really enjoyed reading your work as well. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thanks for taking the time. It's been great talking to you too.
Jacqueline Woodson. She is the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature and has just released two new books, Harbor Me, a middle grade novel, and The Day You Begin, a picture book. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.